Thank you, Tim, and thank you for the invitation, and it's an honor to give a lecture here. I'll use this. So the title of the talk is Pushing the Limits of Aerodynamic Shape Optimization for Unsteady Flows. So motivation. A lot of the cool things, I gave my graduate student on Saturday and asked him to jazz it up, and he put all these things in it. So he went a little too crazy, but I had to take some things out. So this is a typical cartoon image of a helicopter, and the motivation here is that what we're trying to do is to build algorithms that are needed to ultimately do the complete job, which is to solve as quick as possible and optimize the flow for unsteady flows. So we purposely started off with helicopters, mainly because there are a lot more validation and solutions, experimental work done for helicopters that there are compared to turbo machinery and so forth. But the ultimate goal is actually to push forward to incompressible flow and everything else. So here, for those of you not too familiar with it, when a helicopter moves forward in flight, the forward blades, you don't quite see it, but they pitch to close to a 0 degree angle of attack, and as they move backwards, then they increase to close to about 12 degrees or more, depending on the type of blade. And all of this happens as the rotor blade spins. That main reason is being because when you're going forward, the velocity that these blades see are much higher than the velocity here, because you're moving backwards while the helicopter is moving forward, and so you have to pitch these blades up such that you maintain and produce enough of lift so that you don't end up getting a roll. And so as the blade moves forward, then the pitch angle changes as you go around. And so to ultimately try to devise something that solve as quick as possible and optimize, what we have to do is go for the goal of need to extend the stall and compressibility limits to allow higher forward flight. And so if you want to move faster forward, then you have to try to do something about a shock that develops in the forward blade, and at the same time, the same airfoil cross-section has to be able to have very good high angle of attack characteristics such that it wouldn't stall. And that which happens in this blue region. So this is a cartoon image that is pulled off from the website, and what you see here is that you've got a four-bladed rotor. There is a tip vortex that develops from one blade, and it moves along, and it interacts with the following blade. And that blade vortex interaction, in order to get the solution right, you have to get that right. The angle of attack that this blade sees is very different from what it actually is set at, and so there are quite a number of classical experimental cases that have been done and validated for this exact purpose. And so what we needed to do is to try to both do the following. And so what our ultimate game or the motivation is, number one, so for each of them we'll go through what the problem is and what we're trying to do to solve it. So the first one is to stall and compressibility limits the velocity. And in this case, the question is, we're trying to do a rapid redesign of the 2D blade section. So we're trying to develop both the 2D and three-dimensional codes simultaneously, because helicopter companies use both. They do use the two-dimensional codes to look very quickly at characteristics for the blade section themselves. And the student that is working on that is Charles Tatosian. The next one is the simulation of the blade tip vortex interaction itself. And in this case, we are looking at developing a new fully compact scheme in both time and space. And the student looking into that is Jean-Sebastien Kechner. The next one is, so the redesign of the entire flow, and in this case, three-dimensional unsteady viscous design capability. And again, Charles is looking into that. The third problem is the simulation of the fuselage rotor interaction is computationally expensive. And so here you've got a fuselage that is stationary, but the rotor is moving around, and there is an interaction between the two. And so the question is, what do we have to do in order to be able to do that? And in this case, what we're trying to do is extend our current method to develop both the NLFD, what we call the frequency domain solver, which I'll go through in shortly, and the adjoint method for overset grids. And the last one is that the NLFD method that we've been presenting for the last 2 or 3 years tends to be very, very memory intensive. And what we're trying to do is to develop what we call the P-NLFD method to reduce the memory intensivity and to speed up the code. And that one I'm working on myself. Actually assigned a student to do it, but after a couple of weeks it was a little too cool, and so I had to take it away, and so I end up doing it myself. So the talk is sort of in parts, in five different sections. The first one is the complete time-dependent optimal design problem. The second one is the optimum shape design of helicopter rotors, the development of the P-NLFD scheme. The third one is Georges Besten is developing what we call the NLFD-SD, or the SD-NLFD scheme, which is fully compact in time and space. And the last one is the NLFD/adjoint methods for overset chimera meshes. So we'll start off with the time-dependent problem. So we'll kind of quickly, briefly go through this 6 o'clock long day. It's probably not a good idea to go through integral equations. So firstly, we start with introducing the cost function. And probably most of you here have been probably working on the adjoint method, at least if you're from UTIS, and you know these things very well. And so the first step is to take a variation of the cost function. And so here the cost function is a time-dependent integral. And so you're integrating it in time. And L here is some objective function that changes as time increases. And so then delta I gives you this function here. And then the next step is to introduce the time-dependent flow solution. And so this is partial W, partial T. This is your residual, the sum of all your fluxes, the convective, the viscous, and the artificial dissipative fluxes. You take a variation of this, and you end up with these three terms. R here is a function of the state vector and the shape function, the design variables. And so you end up with the following equation. Now, generally, this is thrown out, because if you're doing steady flow, then you don't see this term. But for the steady flow now, for unsteady flows, then you can throw this out. You have to leave it in. Okay. So the next step is to introduce the to pre-multiply that variation of the residue with a Lagrange multiplier and integrate that over the domain, and both in space and time. And then you add that, since this is equal to zero, when you achieve convergence, you subtract that from so you introduce a Lagrangian function, and this is the variation of the cost function, and that's the variation of the residual. And then you move a few terms around, you switch the integration signs, and you end up with the following. And so what you have then at the end is the following function here. This first term is only a function, is multiplied to delta W. And this second term here is multiplied to delta F, which is the shape function. And so this ends up being your adjoint equation, and that ends up being the gradient. This last term here is dependent upon if there is a function, if you introduce two objective functions, one that varies with time and the other one that does not, then you end up having two objective functions. In this case, most of the problems that we do, we only have the first one, so we only have L. We drop M. So this is more of an overall picture of the equations. And so this term, currently this term doesn't exist. So it's only these two. So the next step is then to solve the adjoint equation. There is this terminal boundary condition, which we do not use because M is zero. And lastly, then you end up solving for the gradient. The gradient, in this case, is a summation in time, integral over the time. And so this is the gradient value at each time step, you can think of it. And so if you have a pitching airfoil or a rotating helicopter blade, then at every time step, you have a gradient associated with that, as well as you have an adjoint equation associated with that. So the governing equations that follow, we solving the Navier-Stokes equations. You have the convective fluxes and viscous fluxes, the state, inviscid, and viscous fluxes. we solve them. The spatial discretization use is second order central differencing, and so here you have the fluxes in each of the directions, and you end up with R, which is the complete residual. H, little h, is the sum of your convective, your dissipation, and your viscous fluxes. We are using a JSD artificial dissipation scheme. For the viscous fluxes, we are solving for the viscous flux at the edges and then averaging in order to get the flux through the cell to the edge center. So while we are using the NLVD scheme to do this, is initially we were using a time accurate solver. So this is a second order backward in time, but it turned out to be very, very costly. As you know, for the adjoint equations, you end up with equivalent adjoint equation close to the same computational cost as the flow solver. So you solve the flow solver, you then pass the information to the adjoint solver, you solve that, and then you go compute your gradients. And in the case of the unsteady flow, because the solution is changing in time, then you have solutions, the state vector, at every single time step, which means then you have to end up solving the adjoint at each of these time steps. And so what happens is that in order to solve unsteady optimization problem, it tends to be quite costly even with the adjoint, because you are storing all of these state vectors for each time step. So for a time accurate solution, anywhere from 24, 48 time steps per period is stored or solved. And so you have to store all of them and then go back and solve for the adjoint for each one of this, and then compute the gradients and so forth. So it becomes very expensive. And simultaneously, when I was working on this, I had a colleague, Matthew McMullen, who was working on the NLVD method. And then since then we took on all kind of over it and then started to extend it and derive it for the three-dimensional equations, viscous, and so forth. And so for a simple problem, we get, for two-dimensional flow, we get anywhere from 8 to 10 times the speed up. For three-dimensional problems, we get pretty much similar speed ups, anywhere from 7 to about 9 times speed up for at least the problems we have done so far. So the way that the NLVD method works, let's see how we do it, is that you take, so this is the semi-discrete form of the equations, and what you're doing is you're representing the state vector W and the residual by a Fourier series in time per computational cell. So for each cell, you end up representing the state vector in the form of a Fourier series, and you end up with Fourier coefficients that you have to solve for. K here is the wave number. So since you know what the frequency is, and most of the engineering problems, you do know what the frequency is. So if it's a helicopter, you know what the RPM that you're revolving in, the blade passing frequency for turbo machinery and so forth. So you know what K is, which means you know what the frequency is. And therefore, if you have W, and W here is a function of both space and time. So if you have the state vector at all the x points and at all time steps, then you can solve for W hat, which is the Fourier coefficient of that. You do the same thing with the residual. And then you substitute back into the semi-discrete form of the equations, and what that gives you is a new R star. And that's equals to this term here, IKVI here, being, because it's a complex variable. So this is an additional term plus the coefficient, the Fourier coefficient for the residual. And so what you end up with is, an equation for each wave number. So if you have three time steps, then you end up with just two equations to solve. The zeroth mode. The zeroth mode turns out to be just the time averaged solution, and the first mode. So you just solve. So what you're doing is you're marching the solution to a steady state, periodic steady state solution for each of these modes. So you end up solving two of these equations for each computational cell. And so the way that we do it is through a nonlinear method, everything is stored in the physical domain. Okay? So all the solution vectors, the four at all the computational cells in time and space is stored in the physical domain, we take an FFT of that to get W hat, and once you have W hat, then you can compute the source term. Everything is stored in real numbers, and the FFT is done such a way so there's no, you don't actually end up solving in, the problem in complex. Once you have the state vector, you then compute the residual in time in the physical domain. Okay? Then you do an FFT of this, and you end up with R hat. So now you have W hat and R hat. You take R W hat, you compute the source term, you add it to the R hat in order to get R star. And now you take R star and you march it forward to steady state. So you do, if then you, whatever smoother you're going to be using, whether it's an explicit smoother, RK schemes, PVDRK, or whether you want to do an implicit smoother, LUSDS, or something of that form, then you apply it directly to this set of equations and you march it forward and do one iteration. Once you update the solution, then you do an inverse FFT of W hat to end up getting W in the physical domain, and you then update your wall boundary, your far field boundary conditions, everything in the physical domain, and you repeat this over and over again. And so you store and you compute your residues in the physical domain, but you drive the solution in the frequency domain. Okay? So the adjoint problem comes down to this. We end up in discrete form. So the implementation that we end up doing is in the discrete form. And so you end up, you first introduce your cost function. So for us, we're doing right now fairly simple problems. So the cost function just turns out to be the time average drag. For the helicopter problem, it's CQ, which is the TOG. Okay? And the constraints are time average lift coefficient, or you can look at it as the thrust coefficient, and another constraint is the thickness distribution. Design variables, mesh points and B-spline curves. So we go ahead, we develop the discrete and of the adjoint equations, and you go all this, I'll skip it, and you end up getting a set of equations that are very, very similar to the flow solver, but now it's for the adjoint equations. We do it by hand, and it's cumbersome, it takes a while, but it's enjoyable to do it by hand as well. I think you sort of appreciate the equations and you really do understand what you're doing. I know Kim is looking at me because he does AD adjoint. So, but there are pluses to both. I mean, the main reason why we do it this way is for the sake of just trying to understand the equations better. So shared parameterization, for the longest time we were using mesh points, but now we've graduated and moved on to B-splines. And the optimization algorithm that we use now is, so this is just going through the gradient. We compute the gradient from the adjoint equations. We now do either a second order or fourth order smoothing of it. This is a second order equation. And we end up with a smoothed set of the gradient values. And then we use a conjugate gradient approach to advance the solution. So this is a convergence history of the NLV flow solver. It's not too sharp. So within about 500 multigrid cycles, we hit machine zero. This curve here is the zeroth mode. So this is the time average solution. The black lines, so this is NLV 3, zeroth mode and first mode. And so that's the convergence for the zeroth mode, and that's the convergence for the first mode. And if you go to 5 time steps, it's right smack on. So the zeroth mode for the 3 time steps, the 5 and the 7 are all the same. The first mode is this, and so they're almost the same. The 5 time steps, the 7 does a little bit better, and this at the bottom here is the higher modes. And so if the higher modes have such, I mean, they start off, this number here is 10 to the minus 10, minus 10. So which means the second mode doesn't really play any role for the unsteady solution itself. So it starts off very, very low. So within about 500 multigrid cycles, this is inviscid flow, that's why it's that fast. This is also solving for a helicopter problem in 3D. So this takes probably about 15 minutes on a 12 processor cluster. So this is the grid It's a CH mesh, and it's fairly large grid we're using. So the blade is in the middle. It's 5R in the top, 5R to the bottom, and 5R to the edge. We use what's called the hover boundary conditions, so which means that we use Riemann invariance on the outside, but we assume that there is a source placed in the middle, and then you end up computing the velocity, incoming velocity, based upon assuming a potential flow, a source in the middle. And so that's a view of it. There's a wake region. In this particular grid was our first grid, and we don't have a very thick, very good fine grid in the front, because you need that because of the tip vortex that goes around and comes back again. Now, it's a two-bladed rotor, but we're only solving half of it, so which means we use periodic boundary conditions from left to right. So these are validation cases. That's the 80% and 96%, and you end up, unfortunately, you can't quite see them very well. So there's the experimental value and the solution on the top of it. This is a non-lifting case, and the tip Mach number is at 0.52. This is at 8 degrees at a tip Mach number of 0.44. And this is at a tip Mach number of 0.877 at 8 degrees. And so you end up, the experimental results kind of go, it overshoots, the shock ends up being stronger. The experimental results shock is right here. And here we end up having the shock almost about 5% further. And that mainly is because it's inviscid flow. And with viscous flow, with the turbulence model, you'd be able to place the shock much, much better. And this is the solution for different, it's a pressure distribution for different various time steps. So they all pretty much fall right on top of each other. It's for the 3 time steps, the 5 and the 7, at both at the 80 and the 96% span locations. This is the convergence of the NFD flow solver. So within about 500, all modes go straight down to zero. It's a linear operator, as you know, and so the convergence tends to be much faster than the flow solver. So this is the solution itself. You end up with, this is at the tip Mach number of 0.88, and so you end up having a shock right at the tip. There is a vorticity, the plotting vorticity that shoots off from the tip, and you end up, you can see this is at the periodic boundary condition, you end up producing this is Mach contours, and you end up producing this tip vortex that you can see right here. So it's a two-bladed, but we're only solving for one, and we do a symmetric and copy on the other side. Now, in order to get the picture, so most of the solutions were only done at 3 time steps per period, which means that we're solving, we take the grid, solve at the 0 degrees, we rotate it 120 degrees, solve it at that point, rotate it, solve at 240. So only solving the solution at the 0 degrees, the 120, and the 240. Okay? But in order to get these pictures, then because it's a hover condition and the pitch, the pitch of the blade isn't modified, so you end up getting what should be a steady solution at all points. And so it's the same solution that is copied at all of the angle of attack. And so I think the student copied it at 4 degrees. At every 4 degrees. So this is the initial pressure and the final pressure. So you end up with this very thick shock wave here, and you severely weaken it. So it's pretty much gone. I can show you. This is the top surface of it. So you end up getting this tip shock. And this is only at one condition. And these are, I have bigger, better pictures on this one. Hopefully you'll be able to see them. So let me do that. Okay. So the dotted line is the initial, and the black line is the final pressure distribution. So that's the 80%, the 96. And this is at the, sorry, that would be, this should be the 89%. So 80, 89%, and that's at the 96%. So these were done using the mesh points and with the conjugate gradient algorithm, with smoothing of the gradient itself. So we have to still work on our optimization algorithm side and try to work more on it, but it's very enticing to spend more time on the flow solver and the agile side. And here is the initial and final configurations. Fairly minor detail. These are at the 96, 89, and the 80%. It runs fairly quickly, but granted this is a small grid. This is about 1.5 million points. But it's mostly for making sure it's validating and making sure the gradients are right, it converges and all those things. So this particular case, right from beginning to end, computing the flow over the unsteady flow over the helicopter rotors, and the design of it takes about 45 minutes. So it's about 2 minutes per design cycle. So this is the convergence of the time average drag and the convergence of the change in the objective function. We pretty much always get a fairly linear curve, and then it has a rapid drop at the end. We used to use the steepest descent. Even with the conjugate gradient, we tend to get such a characteristic. So going back to the motivation, so what we've been doing is to try to develop both the two-dimensional and the three-dimensional. I'll briefly go through. The next part is to look at the two-dimensional blade design. So in this case, the objective is to try to model both the pitch of the airfoil and the variation in the Mach number. So the frequency domain code allows us to do that. Unlike a time accurate code, becomes very much a very expensive job of such. In our case, we just have to prescribe an incoming boundary condition where the Mach number is a function of time. And so you've got the airfoil that has been pitched, and that's a function of time, and then the incoming Mach number is also a function of time. And so in this case, our objective function is you're trying to maintain the time average lift and minimize the time average drag, and W here is the weight on both. We did another one where we try to do L over D, so maximize lift and minimize drag. So, can't be quite seen. Let's see. Well, that's unfortunate. Okay. So I'm going to have to tell you, you have to believe me that these curves are there. So on the left-hand side, we're trying to maintain the lift hysteresis. And so the initial and the final are right on top of each other. So there's no quite difference. So that's the constraint. We're trying to maintain the lift at every point in time. And on the right-hand side, we're maximizing the lift hysteresis, and you see an upward shift. So in this particular case, it's a NACA 23012 blade section, and the Mach, Mach number, the mean Mach number is 0.481, and we're pitching it, we're changing the incoming Mach number by plus minus 0.25, and the angle of attack is at 5.5 plus minus 4 degrees. So it's quite large amounts of pitch and 0.48 plus 0.25. So you end up in a transonic region and you end up in a low subsonic region as well, because you have a variation in both the Mach number and the angle of attack. And these are the drag reductions. On the left-hand side, you end up in decreasing the drag at the low Mach numbers, at the low angle of attack, and at the higher angle of attack, it increases slightly. The overall effect is to be able to reduce it. When we used L over D instead of trying to maintain the lift, and the main reason why we're trying to maintain the lift is because for helicopters, pitching moment is a very, very important thing. And so if you end up with very large pitching moments on the retreating phase, then you end up with a lot of fatigue on the blades. And so pitching moment to them is as important as lift is. And to try to maintain lift, in some sense, is to try to maintain our pitching moment. We did do some work where we included pitching moment as well in the objective function, but we're using a penalty function type where we end up having all three different objectives in one, and that becomes very, very restrictive. And so we're trying to move away from that, moving away from penalty function. So sorry again for these What I'm showing here is the pressure distributions on both the different designs. So the next thing is the development of the compact. The next one I'm going to show you is the NRFD method is memory intensive. And so the ultimate motivation here is always to try to do the design itself. And ultimately what we're trying to do is to, what we realized is that we couldn't go just doing, you know, just plugging in the adjoint and going ahead and doing the optimization itself, where the flow solver needed to be improved, mainly due to the fact that it was becoming very, very expensive. And so we had to actually push the limits of trying to get cheaper and cheaper, but at the same time, to improve the accuracy of the results. And so the solution here I'm going to show you is trying to reduce the memory intensiveness of the NLFD method. And so what we have here is what we call the PNLFD method, which is an adaptive in time. Okay? So imagine so that you have two cells, and in the NLFD method, in the time accurate solution, you end up, if you do it, let's say a second order backward in time, you're solving the solution at, you're solving at n plus 1, but you're saving the solution at n and n minus 1, and then you're advancing in time. But in the NLFD method, you are solving, everything is compact, which means that the solution in time is stored for each variable, okay, for each cell. And so let's say in this particular case, let's say you've got two cells, and the cell on the left is using three time steps or only one mode above the zeroth mode. So you end up with solving the periodic flow, but solving it at the three green spots, but the grid or the cell on the right is using five time steps. Okay? So what we're trying to do here is to actually find a way to reduce, to use higher number of time steps, but reducing the memory intensiveness of the algorithm. And so what happens is that we start off where all of the computational cells in the grid use three time steps. And then at some point we augment and we ask the question, we compute what we call the ratio of the spectral energy for each of the cells. So we take the spectral energy for each mode and divide it by the sum of them and find out how large is that largest of the highest mode. If the highest mode has a very large spectral energy, then what that tells us is that that cell needs higher modes. And then what we do is we augment the solution, and we, for each of these cells, then we say, okay, I have three time steps now, and I have to go up to five time steps. So we do an interpolation, a trigonometric interpolation, but through FFT, and then end up increasing per cell. Each cell then ends up going up or down. So you could go up or down based upon whether or not that spectral energy is, what that fraction is. And so, but the problem comes to the fact that let's say you've got two cells, you have to compute the flux through it because it ends up being a finite volume scheme. And you have to compute the flux through this, but this cell uses three time steps and this one uses five time steps. So all the solutions that are stored for this cell are at completely different phases from this one. And so what we have to do is that we then end up at these cell boundaries, we then end up taking this cell, and so this goes by when you're going through each edge of the cell, then we ask this question whether or not we have to do this. And what we do is we take the cell that has the lower number of time steps and increase that to five time steps for that iteration in order to compute the flux through this phase for each one of these cells. So you end up computing the flux for each one of the solutions through. And what you do is you end up getting such a solution. So here is a completely unsteady flow, but each cell is using a different time step. Okay? So in blue is one mode, the dark blue is two, green is three, yellow is four, and red is five. And so this is a time, it's a pitching airfoil, Mach 0.85, and you start at 1 degree and you're pitching it plus minus 2 degrees. The reduced frequency is 0.202. And so here is the overview of it. Out front here you end up only needing one mode. and we end up with a large section of the blue, which is two modes, and then you have the green, and then if you look closer, see, there is shocks that appear at the upper and the lower surfaces, and it turns out that you end up needing, these shocks are moving, okay? They're moving back and forth because the blade is pitching. And so you end up needing higher number of modes where the shock is being moved. And along the surface of the airfoil, you end up needing five time steps. And we got the solution by setting a reference spectral energy of 1 times 10 to the minus 4. And so this is a reference spectral energy that you set to say how much of augmentation that you want to do. And if you reduce this to 5 times 10 to the minus 5, so we just divide it by 5, you end up with such a solution. You end up increasing the cells that require 4 time steps, and now you end up having 5 time steps appearing here, and that's the location of the shock. And this is at 1 times 10 to the minus 5 is the last calculation, and you end up, you don't have any more one mode. Everything ends up being 2, 3, 4, and 5. And you end up having 5 time steps at the location. So what this tells me is that in order to reach 1 times 10 to the minus 5 for the highest mode, all I require, so instead of actually solving for every single grid point with 5 modes, which becomes very, very computational expensive, because 5 modes means 11 time steps. So I have to store in the computer 11 state vectors for each cell. So imagine now if I go, because ultimately the goal is to do the optimization, now my adjoint is going to need that as well. And so one of the main restrictions for going in this route for using the frequency domain is it becomes memory intensive, because you have to store all of this for the flow solver as well as the adjoint solver. And so memory becomes a problem. And our domain decomposition for parallel runs is only in space and not in time. Okay? So by doing this then, to get the same level of accuracy, I would have to run 5 modes for all of the cells. But what this tells me is that in order to reach this, all I need is such a configuration. Now the price that I have to pay is the augmentation I have to do, that's computationally more expensive. Plus at the cell boundaries, I have to now, at each of these edges, I have to ask the question whether or not I have to increase or drop the neighboring order. So this is a solution of all three of them, and by reducing, so going from minus 4 to minus 5, what you end up doing is introducing more of the 5 modes. So this is the solution again, but what I'm doing is I'm showing the evolution in multigrid for each of them. So I start off at 506 multigrids. Most of it is in, most of my cells are second mode. I have a little bit of first mode. And then as I go, I pretty much have converged after about 1,000 multigrid cycles. And I end up with a little bit of the fifth mode in purple. I have a little bit of the fourth mode, and then most of them tend to be the third mode, and then a little bit of the second and very little of the first. If I drop my spectral energy further, then you see more of the fourth mode and the fifth mode coming in. And if I drop it even further, I end up losing all of my first modes. But for the most part, instead of having all of my cells at the highest mode, I still am able to use quite a bit of the third mode and the fourth mode. Okay. So memory-wise is much, much less. And the same applies to the adjoint, and that's something that we're still developing right now. But it should apply identical to it. Okay. The next thing, taking this concept, the next thing is to try to push forward. If I were to do optimization where I'm trying to optimize for the interaction of the tip vortex on the blade with the adjoint, it's very, very attractive to do the adaptive time step using the error that the adjoint can give you. And so you can do this in space and time. And so what we're doing here in order to push this boundary is to develop a fully compact scheme. So this is what we call the spectral difference / NLFD method. So very briefly, this is your computational cell. That's the solution grid. And these are where the solutions are stored. And based on these solutions, then we compute the the flux points at the solution grids. We take the flux values at the solution grids and do the differentiation in order to get grad dot f at the flux grids. Okay, there are higher order polynomials that span. So I don't have a picture that shows you the polynomial that covers that cell. So this is per cell. And that's for, this here is done in space. Okay? So this is, right now you can go up to fourth, fifth, sixth order, but the code is written up and the calculations I'll show you is for third order accurate in space. And so you have a high order enough polynomial at the flux points. So this is very much similar to a finite element type of a scheme. And but what we did was we took this and we added the NLFD to that. Since the frequency domain solver is already compact, then if we add this to this capability, then what I'm doing then is that I have W, my state vectors, stored at the solution points. Now the question is, what if I advanced in time by assuming that each of these values then can be represented by a Fourier series? Then what I end up is a finite volume scheme that is fully compact in both space and time. So each computational cell then can be in any order, based on the P adaptation that you do, and the time in the time domain as well, you could do the P and L of D that we just showed you. Now this makes deriving the adjoint horrendously complicated, but is heck of a lot of fun. Okay. So this is the solutions that we have. This is a 192 by 31 grid pitching airfoil, and this is the pressure distributions at various different angle of attack, and I can show you the pressure contours here. This is done with a third order in space and three time steps in time. And these are the lift heuristics. So the blue is the original finite volume using 384 by 64, five time steps, and then in red and green, which pretty much lies right on top of each other, we're using 192 by 31 grid. One is at three time steps and the other at five time steps. And these are the iterations to get to a converged solution. And so pretty much the zeroth mode for the three and the five converged down to it's after about 1,000 iterations is down to about minus six. It tends to be a little bit costly because of the memory wise and the smoothing that we're doing. It's an explicit smoother, so this is a PBDRK scheme. An implicit one, we just have put it in for a simple wave advection problem, and it drastically reduces, makes it much faster. So the last thing, the last thing is ultimately, in order to complete the full design, one of the attractiveness of the frequency domain solver for optimization is the fact that you're only solving the solution at particular phases. And unlike so imagine if you wanted to do a full fuselage of the helicopter rotor as plus the rotating grid of the rotor, then you have a background mesh for the fuselage, and then on the top of that you've got an overset mesh for the rotating grid. Every time you rotate, now your points are definitely not going to be aligned. And what you have to do is go through a whole cutting procedure and to find out interpolation schemes and so forth. In our case, because we only end up needing three or five time steps, I can do all of these post or pre-processing up front. So I can do all of the whole cutting and all of that up front for just three time steps. Store that and then use even a better, instead of doing in high order interpolation, we can do a fully conservative transfer between the grids. And so what we're trying to do in this case is develop. Sorry about this. So overset meshes. I just have this one slide to show this is something we just started in the last couple of months. And what we're doing here is that you have overall background mesh. We're just solving for two-dimensional problems. So it probably won't be 3D at least for another 2 years. But in this case, we have a background mesh that does not move. And then you have a smaller mesh around the airfoil that actually moves. And so then you end up pitching this at various angle of attacks, and you do go through the whole cutting procedure, the whole overset mesh criteria. But for computing, for sensitivity analysis and computing the adjoint becomes quite complicated. mainly because now we have to go back and start to rewrite the adjoint equations, because you end up needing to interpolate the values from one to the other. And so the adjoint boundary conditions in the far field and all that needed to be redone as well. But ultimately, this, what it allows to do is to do unsteady flows overset for adjoint capability with the NFD code. So conclusion is that I know most of the talk were geared towards the CFD side, but we started off putting the three-dimensional flow solver, adjoint capability, compute the gradient, solve it, advance the solution. But what we realized is that in order to actually do it, it became too memory intensive. Computationally, it was still costly, because even if it's so much better than the time accurate, it was still memory and computationally costly. And so what we needed to do is go back and sort of rethink what are the areas we needed to advance in order to make it better. And so what we ended up coming up with is the first one, of course, in the last couple of years, is the development of the adjoint equations for unsteady flows for the NLFD method for both 2D and 3D. And then the development of the PNLFD method, the SDNLFD, and with the adjoint capability, then we could actually adapt. So if you go back to the first slide, how do you grab the first slide? Okay, that's okay. I'll show it to you after this. If you go back to the when I go back to the first slide, you see that tip vortex. And so the goal for us is that in a couple of years, we would be able to use the adjoint, using the gradient sensitivity and the adjoint to do error correction, such that our adaptation in both space and time is done via while you're going through the design. And so you're using the adjoint in order to do error correction, but to use it to do adaptation. And with a fully compact scheme, then each cell could have a different order in both space and time by solving the adjoint equation simultaneously. And so the development of both the PNLFD and the SDNLFD, and then ultimately would be an adjoint method for overset meshes as well. What we hope is that this would help us complete the problem. So with that, I would love to entertain any questions. Thank you again for the invitation. This is 1.5 million, but we're only doing 12 processes. 12 processes. So each. Remember that we're not doing. So the 500 multigrade cycles is for the first design cycle. So for the second design cycle, we only do.